Why Study Revelation? The first talk in a series on the Book of Revelation was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 7, 2013 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number one in this series.
Okay, the Book of Revelation. I have never in my life taught Revelation. I have sworn several times I never would. Every time I ever opened it, it just seemed absolutely impossible, absolutely impenetrable. I had no hope of ever really being able to make any sense out of it at all. I assumed that what I did get to know it enough to think that what I really need to do is understand the Old Testament prophets. And once I understand the Old Testament prophets and I know their symbolism, I know their language, I know the prophetic scheme that they paint and so on, then maybe, just maybe, I'll be able to read Revelation and make some kind of sense out of it. But in the absence of having that kind of knowledge, and I'm a New Testament guy, I've spent so little time in the Old Testament, relatively speaking, that I didn't know what the prophets said, not really. I just kind of despaired of ever really being able to make sense of it because I just didn't feel like I was equipped to do it. Then the world changed. And over the last two or three years, I have found the last two or three years very challenging emotionally for me because in my perception, we are seeing the unraveling, the falling apart, the crumbling of something. And it is crumbling and unraveling so fast, so amazing, that it almost seems supernatural to me. Nothing can unravel that fast as American culture is. I think there's no question, but apart from another Reformation, and you always have to hold out the possibility of something like that, but apart from another revelation, I don't think there's any question, but we are seeing the death throes of American culture and American civilization. So even if it's not the end of the world, it's the end of what we have known, at least old people like me who've grown up in something very different. It's the end of something that we've known. And that got me thinking, if it's the end of America, is it the end of time? Now, it's kind of obviously kind of arrogant to think that what I'm a part of must be important enough that it would be the thing that would go on. And if it ends, the whole world ends. Because I'm sure that there are people throughout all of history who've seen the end of the Roman Empire and seen the end of the crumbling of the feudal system in the Middle Ages, who have looked at everything unraveling and everything falling apart around them and said, this must be the end of time. So I know that we are not unique in human history. But all I'm trying to explain to you is, as I saw what looked like the end of the world encroaching, I decided, don't you have to read and understand Revelation before the world ends? I mean, isn't that how it's supposed to work? So I started reading and rereading and rereading and rereading. And to my surprise, it actually began to kind of make some sense to me and take shape for me. And that's when I decided maybe, just maybe, I can tackle this. And we can learn it together. Now, this will be unlike anything else that I've ever taught. I like to try to think, at least, that I understand a book before I teach it. I do think that I understand the major outlines of the Book of Revelation, but there are many details that still completely escape me. So I'm not going to have answers to all your questions. What I would like to propose is, I don't have the confidence to tell you that this is what I think Revelation is saying in every detail. But I do have the confidence to say, I think I have an approach to Revelation that's worth looking at, that's worth considering. And so that's really all I'm claiming for this, is I want to present something that I think is worth us considering together. I want to approach it the same way I did in the last series. We'll have a kind of a, a conversation together, so I will pause relatively frequently for your questions and comments, and we'll just see where that goes. I'll give the same warning that I did there. If I don't take on your question or your comment exactly directly, please give me the liberty to do that, because in anticipation of covering it later, or if I think that it's esoteric enough that it's not of general interest, it doesn't mean that I disrespect your comment or your question. I'm just trying to be sensitive to the fact that there's more than the two of us talking here. So please give me the liberty to do that. But I do want to give an opportunity for conversation here. The primary reason I decided to teach it is not just because as I said, it began to take some shape for me, but as it began to take shape for me, I really began to grasp what I think is the message of Revelation. And the message of Revelation, I think, is very important and very powerful and much needed by us today. I fear that American culture, I mean, it, as a part of the unraveling of American culture, something that's correlated with that is the unraveling of the Christian church in a lot of ways. Because I'm afraid that we are increasingly becoming a culture of unbelieving believers. And what I mean by that is there really are kinds of two ways of thinking about being a Christian. I was in a conversation just this week that was really helpful. It reminded me, it highlighted for me how to be a disciple, and by that I mean somebody who's sitting under the teaching of Jesus and wanting to learn from Jesus, sitting under the lordship of Jesus and wanting to obey his exhortation, to follow his teaching. That's what I mean by a disciple. But to be a disciple of Jesus is never something that can be passive. If you are a disciple of Jesus, you are actively, proactively pursuing what is it that Jesus is teaching, and what is it that he's requiring of me? And we have to necessarily make an existential choice, an existential commitment. We have to face the teaching of Jesus and decide personally, individually, existentially, I want my life to be defined and to be marked by my obedience to this man Jesus. Anything short of that is not really discipleship. And all too often, we think that we can kind of surround ourselves with the institutions, the language, the practices of Christians, and absorb it passively. As long as I don't resist it, as long as I don't reject it, as long as I'm kind of sympathetic toward the stuff of Christianity, doesn't that make me a Christian? Now, we've all recognized that there's nominal Christians and there's Bible-believing Christians. What I'm talking about is nominal Bible-believing Christians. Christians who know that you're supposed to follow the Bible, you're supposed to listen to the Bible, you're supposed to pay attention to the Bible, all the stuff that distinguishes us from just cultural Christians. We know that it's supposed to be more important than that. But it's very, very possible to be a Bible-believing Christian, but to not really be one. Because I have not proactively decided I'm going to consciously, deliberately, and purposely embrace this truth, pursue this truth, and proactively learn what Jesus has to teach me. Well, one of the symptoms that we are not believing believers, that we're unbelieving believers, I think is how we respond to something like the book of Revelation. Because if you're anything like me, your initial reaction to Revelation is, dude, this is just weird. This is totally weird stuff. There's two reasons for that. One is, most of us have never read the Old Testament, so we don't know about Ezekiel and Zechariah, but you know, leaving that aside, it's the only book of the Bible that we have encountered that uses a symbolic language and is from beginning to end teaching us, speaking to us, communicating in a very, very symbolic language as opposed to more straightforward prose. So that, of course, already makes it, sets it apart and makes it totally weird. But the other thing is, and I think this is just as important, is we don't really believe that one day I'm going to come back with Jesus and have to slay the bad guys. I mean, one of the things that was striking to me was the realization that if I understand how to put Revelation together, after I die, my next conscious moment is to be raised from the dead, transformed into the glorious state that I'm going to be in for all of eternity, and I'm going to go to battle at the Battle of Armageddon. And, you know, okay, in the movies you do that kind of thing. I mean, there's Lord of the Rings, and you have big epic battles in a movie, but that's not real life. Never in my life have I fought in an epic battle. And so the fallacy of ordinary experience, the fallacy that life and reality is just going to keep chugging along day in and day out the same way it's always been going along, it's easy to get lulled into the fallacy of thinking that's the only thing that's true, that's the only thing that's real, and that's the only thing that will ever be a part of my existence. Well, if Revelation is true, that's not true. And it's just like 2 Peter, where he warns that the mockers and the scoffers, the people who hold the gospel in contempt, they ask the question, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues just as it was from the beginning of creation. Nothing is new, nothing is different, no weird stuff ever happens. The sun rises and the sun sets, and you work your 8 hours, or for some people it was 12 or 15 hours in between. And it's always been that way, and it's always going to be that way. So what's this stuff about Jesus coming back? That makes no sense. But as Peter argues there, well, it escapes your notice that at one time the whole world was destroyed by a flood, when God came in wrath and God came in judgment and destroyed, wiped mankind virtually off the earth because of their ungodliness. Dramatic things do happen in the scheme of things as God scripts history. And one very dramatic event happened in the time of Noah, and there's something equally dramatic ahead of us. And that, I'm going to argue, is what Revelation is describing and explaining to us, is the dramatic events that are going to mark the end of this time and the beginning of the next time. But because it seems so fantastical to us, or let me put it this way, if that just seems fantastical to us, it's because we really have not absorbed that there is a real God who really is there, who really has scripted history, and who really has revealed to us some of the outline of that script of history, and I need to believe it and base my life on that truth. And it's not that we, in our passivity, it's not that we reject it. We just don't really choose to believe it, if you understand what I'm saying. We don't say, no, that can't be. We just say, it doesn't compute. I don't even know what to do with that. And I think the message of Revelation, if I'm understanding the message of Revelation, is we absolutely have to let it compute. Because when we understand what Revelation is teaching us, it is very sobering. It confronts us with the message. I'd articulate the messages this way. When the first message is, make no mistake, God will come in judgment against his enemies, and God will ultimately destroy all evil. That's a fact. That's a reality. At the end point of the present time and at the end point of the present age, and I'll make a distinction between those as we go, but at the point of the end, God is going to judge and destroy all evil. No evil will be left undestroyed. Well, we have to take that in And we have to understand that, because if we side with evil, we are siding with our own destruction. That's one of the foremost messages of Revelation. When God finally comes in judgment and chooses to establish his kingdom, you don't want to be on the wrong side. That's not happy news, but it's important news. It's critically important that we understand that and have it do more than just flash across our intellect. It has to sink in and cause us to make an existential commitment. If it's true that I don't want to be on the wrong side, then how can I purposely, consciously, intentionally, and deliberately choose and act like someone who wants to join the right side? I've got to do that. I can't just passively coast through here thinking I'm a Christian. I have to assume responsibility for what I'm going to do with Jesus. The other message, I think, is that at the end of this present time, and this is an important theme in Revelation, at the end of this present time, it will appear that evil has won. I think things are going to get so bleak and so dark, and evil is going to be so seemingly triumphant that it will appear that evil has the upper hand and that evil has won. The message of Revelation is, take care that you not seek to make peace with the powers of evil in order to protect your life. Choose to die rather than reject belief in Jesus. And we can, with a Peter-like bravado, say, oh, I will always choose to die rather than reject Jesus. But the truth of the matter is, we are going to have to, some human beings, are going to be asked to make that choice when it looks like embracing Jesus is stupid and crazy, because Jesus is lost. It's evil that has triumphed. It's evil that has won. And part of the message of the book of Revelation is, I don't care how much it looks like evil has won, God is absolutely and completely in control of the script of history, and he's just waiting for the time to send his son back to defeat all of the enemies of God and to destroy them completely. But it's going to happen. And if we have chosen to compromise our belief in Jesus in order to make peace for ourselves in this world, we are fools. We've chosen the wrong side. We've chosen the side that is ultimately the losing side. So the very critical message of Revelation is, don't you dare do that. You are absolutely crazy if you do that. Keep in mind, Jesus is telling us ahead of time, yes, it's going to look bleak, but I'm going to win. I will be victorious. Okay, let me pause there for any comments or questions before I want to look at what it is about symbolic literature that makes it so difficult, and I want to illustrate that. But any comments or questions before I do that?
Best guess on a date?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
What's the best guess on a date that this was written? Revelation. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I haven't even looked at that. I haven't gone into it that deeply. I know that most people date it very late in the first century. How late is the question that I haven't really examined. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that it's before 70 AD. It may not be, but that'll become important to some interpretations of Revelation. But for the sake of argument, I'm going to assume that it's before 70 AD.
So I haven't read Revelation, so, to keep that in mind. But we folks, being fallible, have often misunderstood what God has meant in the Bible, and what signs have been telling us or whatnot, and we've missed it. I mean, they missed it when Jesus was born. They wanted a king that would deliver them from the Romans, and they completely, way over their heads there. But the point is that there could be another way to look at things when we're talking about biblical interpretation and whatnot. And I'm not saying that this is necessarily a salvation issue, but do you see another option for the way that this could be interpreted, what you've stated?
Another option other than the one I'm going to present, you mean?
Yeah, but also with what you've been talking about, my understanding is that this has been, you're heaven bound or you're going down in the ring of fire or lake of fire. So, I mean, that just with what you're about to say, but also with what you've just been saying.
Well, yeah, there are a couple of assumptions behind what I just said that are based on my particular reading of Revelation. And there are people throughout church history who have not read it the way that I've read it. In fact, there are some interpretations of Revelation that are kind of optimistic rather than pessimistic. And they see the church growing and succeeding and triumphing. The church triumphant is going to triumph until, the end of time, until the Lord comes again. That's not my reading. But there are believers who have read it that way. If we have time, I'll talk a little bit about the alternative, the different approaches to Revelation and where I fall within that. But yeah, what I'm proposing is I'm confident enough. I wouldn't be up here teaching this if I weren't confident enough to think I might very well be right about looking at Revelation this way. As you're taking the, I'm sorry, Christine here. I think one of the purposes of Revelation is that unlike the coming of the Messiah, for example, I think the purpose of Revelation is specifically to equip you and me to have enough of an outline of what's going to go down that that when it unfolds, we will recognize it, that we will see it. I do think that's the purpose of Revelation. So we're not just, unlike the people who had a certain set of concrete expectations of who the Messiah would be and who he would look, what he would look like and so on, I'm not going to give you that. I mean, and I don't want to disappoint you, but I don't think Revelation gives us that. And that's where I'm going to differ from a lot of interpreters. I don't think I can predict how history is going to go from here by understanding the book of Revelation. But what I do think I know is that when the critical events, and they're relatively few and far between, but when the critical events do unfold, I know what they are, I know where they line up in relationship to each other, and I can be forewarned that we're here. This is the end. And I am not at all convinced that we are at the end. I mean, I'm less convinced after studying Revelation than I was before. I'm not at all convinced that we're at the end of time. I am convinced we're at the end of American civilization, but I don't think we're at the end of time. But when the right signs come, I'll change my mind about that. Christine?
Have you done much thinking about what the purpose was for God to make history line up in this way, to have it appear as though good has lost and evil has won?
I haven't thought about it a lot, but if in fact we're a part of this grand dramatic story, you know, one of the literary devices that we have in narratives is dramatic reversal. And I just think that that's what we're going to see at the end of this time, where, you know, Snidely Whiplash has the heroine on the railroad track and the train is coming and Dudley Do-Right comes in right at the last minute and saves her. That's a mainstay of human narrative, of human stories, where just in the nick of time, the hero comes and saves us. And I just think that's what Revelation is. Revelation is telling us that it's going to look bleak, it's going to look desperate, and Jesus is going to come back just in the nick of time and save mankind from ungodliness.
So that's a description again of what's going to happen. But
right. Why?
Any more thoughts about why?
Well, it's not a question for me. The why sort of takes care of itself if I appreciate the fact that this is a story, that this is a drama, that this is a narrative. And that, you know, that's been an adjustment that I've been making over the years, because I think most of us and a lot of our theological questions come out of a framework where we think of history as kind of a set of laws and principles and mechanisms, and we expect that, well, shouldn't it work in the most efficient way possible? Well, that works if you're creating a mechanism or a system, is that you create it in the most efficient and straightforward and rational way possible. But if you're telling a story, then you tell the story that is interesting, and you tell the story that reveals something about that you want to reveal as an author. And so in that regard, what is that going to reveal about God as the author? His absolute might and power and omnipotence. I mean, he gets you in a position where it looks like things are so bad God can't even fix it. And then he does. In a spectacular and dramatic and mighty way, he comes in and delivers mankind from evil. And that dramatic way in which he does that reveals the absolute sovereign power of God. There is no power to match him.
So that would reveal the character or who God is.
Right.
My thought was, is he trying to reveal who we are?
That's a part of it. We'll see. There's a very striking passage in there, kind of giving you a peek ahead. But as I understand the outline, God shoots four warning shots across the bow, and then after four warning shots, he resolves, okay, we got to judge. They're not responding to this. We're going to have to judge mankind, and judgment comes in stages. Then after two of the stages of the judgment, right up to the very end, God does these incredibly, incredibly destructive things against evil. And the text says, even after all these things, they did not repent of their immorality, their fornication, their idolatry, and whatever else. And that just screamed volumes about the nature of human beings to me. Is that God can make his reality, his wrath, his impending wrath, as absolutely clear and evident and dramatic as he possibly can, and mankind still won't repent.
Just
apart from the supernatural grace of God changing a person's heart.
Kind of like what Pharaoh did.
Like who?
Pharaoh, when...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly like that. So I do think that's true. One of the themes in Revelation is an important glimpse into the inherent intrinsic hardness of human beings against God. We are not interested in bowing the knee to God, period. And it just highlights all the more what a miracle it is that any of us believe. Because it's not in us. It doesn't come naturally to us. We will always find a way not to believe if we can. So it's only by the grace of God that he keeps us and draws us to himself.
Clarification for one of the words you've used. Age. Are you and the apostles using that to just designate the stretch of time of this reality, or is there something more specific that you're...
Yeah, I think it's a fairly flexible and plastic term, but... The way I'm going to use it is I'm going to distinguish this present age from the eternal age. So when we move from this heaven and this earth to a new heaven and a new earth, whatever that means and whatever that looks like, we leave this creation and we are a part of an entirely new created order. Now, whether he literally reinvents physics and starts over, or whether he somehow has built into this present age the mechanisms to reorganize themselves into a new, I don't know the answer to that. But that's the demarcation between this present age and the age to come, the eternal age. When I talk about coming to the end of present time, what I mean by that is the time in which we live, there's going to be a very distinctive dividing point. Jesus is not here right now. He's going to be here later. And when Jesus does come back, Revelation is going to tell us, will rule with a rod of iron. And I think what we see is he's going to impose peace on the whole earth. But notice it will be an imposed peace. It won't be a voluntary peace. People will be too afraid of his power and his strength to defy him. And so they will not take up arms against each other because he's not allowing it. So there will be a time of peace on earth, and that's what traditionally has been called the millennium. And just by the way, my study of Revelation has made me a premillennialist, for those of you who know what that means. I have always been inclined toward amillennialism, but I've changed my mind. I don't know how I missed it, actually, but I'd read Revelation 20 and go, well, you know, you could make this work. I don't know what to do with that. Well, I should have paid attention to I don't know what to do with that, because it was I don't know what to do with that part that when I finally recognized what he was saying, he's saying that Jesus is going to come back and rule literally, physically, with believers. And I've already claimed Cottage Grove for myself. we will reign with him, and that for the 1,000 years, whatever length of time that is, there will be peace on earth with Jesus and his servants reigning over the rest of mankind that has survived at that time, at which time we come to the end of that present time, or the end of the millennial time. Sorry, I confused you. So I'm calling this present time up until when Jesus comes again. Then the time after this present time is the millennium, and the millennium will end with one more battle where all these people who have been living in peace decide to defy Jesus and take up arms against him to go to battle and destroy him. And that's when God destroys them. And that's the end of the present age. Basically, with that, this whole created order is left behind, and we enter into a new created order altogether. And that's what I'm calling the transition from the present age to the eternal age.
Without wanting to sound like a mocker, I'm a bit skeptical, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I've always kind of relegated Revelations to the crackpot end of the Bible, mostly because it's mostly taught out of when a Democrat is in the White House. So, we're talking about civilization, just because all you boomers are going to die. I'm not sure that qualifies American civilization to pass away. Nothing personal. I'm not saying you can hand the torch off politely, but we're going to pick it up eventually. So I get it. There's a big culture. Yeah, I understand what you're saying there, but I'm still saying to you, really, American civilization's at an end? Because really? You keep talking
remember your Gutenberg education.
No, I get it.
Rome did not last forever.
Sure, but who's talking about Rome? Like, I'm just simply saying that there's a whole lot of you boomers, and I get that your time is coming to an end, but that doesn't mean American civilization is going to end.
Okay.
Now, two, American Christianity. You keep talking about it like it's around, like it's there and it's going to put up a fight of some kind. Like, again, remembering my Gutenberg education, I could have swore American Christianity ended some 2,000 years ago. So what are we talking about actually when you say pick sides? And are you sure American civilization is going? Because what do you mean by civilization?
Okay, well,
that's what you're up against with me. There might be some other people who think I'm crazy, but I'd like you to at least address the fact that I've heard this, the pie in the sky of Revelations talked about since I was a little kid in church, and I ain't never seen nothing happen.
Now, what do you mean pie in the sky? What do you
the idea that the Revelation is drug out for the purpose of patting us all on the head and telling us it's going to be okay even though there's a Democrat in the White House. Like, this kind of weird paranoia we have about the other culture that exists in America that seems to be, like, the culture war idea that seems to be so dominant in American Christianity. Like, I don't see exactly where that war ever was waged. Do you understand?
No. Well,
okay, American Christianity.
Where that war ever was waged?
Yes.
What?
So, American civilization is coming to end soon-ish. I don't know. Two, I don't know that American Christianity has ever represented biblical Christianity. So if there was ever a war, I'm sure we lost that a long time ago. Maybe when we were taking the land from the Indians or something. Like, do you see my skepticism about America being such a big deal?
Yeah, I see it.
Okay, I hope so. Because I'm laying it on pretty thick.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are about
I know.
15 and a half questions there.
There were.
I'm not sure what American Christianity has to do with it. The side I'm talking about is not with American Christianity. The side that we need to be on, according to Revelation, is Jesus' side.
Sure.
And that probably in the end will decidedly make you against American Christianity.
I would hope so.
I don't think there's probably little question about that. So I'm not sure how to interact with that.
I want you to keep in your mind that I'm not planning necessarily. Again, I'm more of an existentialist. So I could die on the way home, but not planning necessarily for the world to come to an end. I mostly expect you guys to pass, and then I'll get old, and then somebody will talk about Revelations again a few more hundred times before I die, and it to keep going on like that for a while. Now, granted, if a guy pops up that does stuff that my Gutenberg education would teach me to recognize, that might be a little easy, but I'm having trouble wrapping my mind around what the hell the Book of Revelations is about.
Okay. Well, if I can get personal.
Please do.
Be warned.
Okay.
To take the attitude that I should only expect that the older generation will die, and then I will come along, and I will raise my kids, and then I will grow old, and everything will be fine, because everything is going to go on just as it always has had. I think that's a mistake. Now, it hasn't been for many, many generations. That's been exactly the way their life has gone. And it may very well be the way your life. And in fact, I'm thinking it probably will be. Because I don't think the things are in place to create the kind of picture that Revelation does. I mean, a lot of things have to change, I think, before we're really ready to see the things in Revelation unfold, I believe. Sure. But things have been happening fast in recent days, and they're accelerating, and I'm not gonna say we're safe. These things don't apply to us.
It's not about being safe, and I'm not ultimately skeptical, because the fact that the Jews have ended up back in Israel is a fascinating historical occurrence
that
remarkably seems to indicate that there's something happening. There's a big deal at the end of the show. I'm skeptical after my 34 years of listening to preachers at pulpits tell me the end is nigh. That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Like, well, there's a reason. I think there's a reason for that. One is that we do begin to, I mean, as we see the end of things that we are comfortable with, it raises the question. It always raises the question, okay, what else is it the end of? Is it the end of the world? And I think oftentimes we make really hasty predictions. I mean, notice I'm not doing that.
No, I appreciate that.
I mean, I've backed off and said, I'm, you know, really, if I were betting, I'd bet we're not at the end of time yet. But interestingly, Jesus revealed this almost 2,000 years ago. It's remained relevant to every generation throughout that time. Because even if it's not the end of the present time, even if I don't need to get ready for that, the message still pertains to me today. Think about whose side you're on. You better be on the right side. And that's what I was saying at the very first, is it's calling me to a personal, particular, intentional, existential commitment. I need to pursue proactively, deliberately, purposely, I need to pursue my relationship with Jesus. I need to become his disciple. Not just kind of call myself that and hang around people who do and absorb it passively. I need to proactively decide this is what my whole existence is about. Because those are the people who are, in the end, going to find the reward that Revelation describes. And Revelation is schizophrenic. It talks about destruction, but it talks about incredible, unfathomable, unimaginable blessing. And the issue is, which are you going to have, destruction or blessing? Those people who choose to proactively follow Jesus will have blessing. Those who reject him are going to have, for whatever reasons, are going to be destroyed. And that was as relevant to John as it will be to whoever is in your shoes at the end of time, where the warning shots are being fired across the bow, and they should know good and well that we're at the end of time now.
Okay. I'll have more questions later.
Okay. All right. Let's get back to my notes here. What makes interpreting Revelation difficult? Let's explore that a little bit. And you have a handout illustrating the difficulty of interpreting the symbolism in Revelation. And I tried to illustrate that by this is not out of Revelation, I made this up, but what if in Revelation you found this vision? And I looked into the heavens and I saw an eagle tethered to a golden crown. Then suddenly the tether was loosed and the eagle was released. The eagle flew away to a mountain and built a nest on the mountain. There's several different ways we could interpret this, and all of them hinge on what is a symbol of what, and how you adjust how you connect the symbols is going to make all the difference in the world in as to what possible interpretations you can give to it. So in the first one, I have the eagle symbolize the believer, the golden crown symbolizes God, the nest on the mountain symbolizes a place of rest for the eagle, or therefore the believer. And the message is, a believer in Jesus can never attain to his final place of rest until he is given leave by God to do so. Something like that. There is a whole approach to studying Revelation that looks first at trying to make the book of Revelation be teaching abiding, universal, persistent principles or persistent truths. It really has little to do with the future. It's not really predicting anything in the future necessarily, except parts of it might be, but that for the most part, it's just in symbolic language, it's just the vision representing important truths that we have to keep in mind that will be always true throughout all of time. And that's what some people call the spiritual approach to Revelation. The spiritual approach is just looking for spiritual truths that are encoded or embedded in these symbolic visions, a string of symbolic visions. And I don't know the interpreters who go this direction, I don't know their stuff well enough, but kind of my surface impression is they don't even really try to make Revelation all that coherent from beginning to end. It's more like just this truth and then this truth and then this truth and then this truth. I may be wrong about that, but I don't see a great deal of effort to see any kind of real coherence to the picture that it's giving you. Second interpretive approach, and let's take a second interpretation. The eagle symbolizes the church. The golden crown symbolizes the Roman Empire. The mountain symbolizes Rome. And the nest on the mountain symbolizes occupation of the city of Rome by the church. So the message is a prediction of the event of the Christian church, who currently is in bondage to the Roman Empire, gaining their freedom from Rome, prevailing over Rome, and establishing itself in Rome, being at peace in Rome as its home. Now, this would be the approach to Revelation that would be taken by people who believe that Revelation is what they call apocalyptic literature. And I don't know a lot about this. I just remember going to a seminar years and years and years ago by Bruce Metzger, who was giving a lecture on apocalyptic literature and claiming that Revelation was in that genre. But the basic idea of apocalyptic literature was that the reason it uses symbolism is because it needs to go under the radar of the authorities. You want to give a message that is an insurrectionist message or in rebellion against Rome. So you don't want to be out there out front talking about down with Caesar, off with his head. You can't say that kind of thing out loud because it's your head that rolls. So you say that through symbolism that's kind of obscured and unavailable to your enemies. You're talking to each other. You're not wanting to talk to the enemy, Rome himself. And the message is always, you might be under the thumb of Rome now, but be of good cheer. Rome is going to be defeated, Jesus is going to defeat Rome. That's another approach that people take the Revelation, and they see it as apocalyptic literature. Third kind of interpretation, what if the eagle symbolized the Romans, the golden crown symbolizes God, the mountain symbolizes Jerusalem, and the nest on the mountain symbolizes a home or domicile in Jerusalem? That could be a prediction of the event of God releasing the Romans to go to Jerusalem, destroy it, and establish their own, that is a Roman domicile there. Now notice that happened in history. That is exactly how history went. This is what's called typically the preterist approach to Revelation. And the preterist approach to Revelation basically sees the visions, the prophetic visions in Revelation, as primarily concerned with describing the events that surround God's judgment of the Jews in Jerusalem in 70 AD, 70 to 120 AD. And that it's God filling in some of the details that were hinted at by Jesus in his prophetic words, that he's filling in the details. Here's what's going to happen to Jerusalem. Why? Because the Jews in Jerusalem, all the blood of all the prophets from what's his name, have been shed by them, and God's going to hold them into account. His son came to them, they rejected him and killed him. God is going to judge them and hold them into account. And it's the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 and 120 AD that fulfills that. Now that's true. Jesus predicted that and gave that interpretation to the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem. So that's true. This approach to Revelation focuses on those events as the focal point of Revelation. That's what it's concerned about. So they take all the visions and turn them into a prediction of events surrounding 70 AD. The fourth interpretation, the eagle symbolizes the American colonies, no duh. A golden crown symbolizes the English monarchy. The nest on the mountain symbolizes a home for the eagle. And this makes it a prediction of the event of the American colonies gaining their freedom from the English monarchy and establishing their own independent homeland. This is considered what they call the historicist approach. The historicist approach to Revelation just basically assumes at the outset that Revelation is going to go through time, the history of the church and God's dealing with the church and its relationship to other historical events. As we march through time, Revelation is giving us different visions that give us a snapshot of important events in the development of the history of the church over time. Arguably, the establishment of the American colonies would be an important event in that history. So that maybe Jesus was revealing that to John. It is interesting that people who take a historicist approach, quite understandably, their recognition of what it is being predicted is always in their past. It's not in their future, apart from the millennium and the eternal age, of course. Everybody agrees with that. But everything else always tends to be in their past. A fifth interpretation, the eagle symbolizes Jesus. The golden crown symbolizes God, the absolute sovereign over all of creation. The mountain symbolizes Jerusalem. And the nest on the mountain symbolizes residence in Jerusalem. And the vision is a prediction of the event of God finally granting Jesus the freedom to go establish his sovereign reign over Israel and the whole world from his throne in Jerusalem. And that is what people sometimes call the futurist approach, where it looks at the events of Revelation that are being predicted as for the most part, events that are still in our future and are actually at the end of this present time, the way I've described this present time, and therefore remain in our future. My view is akin to the futurist approach. I think that's what's going on. And I don't have time here this morning, but before too long, we can talk about why would I take a futurist approach over these other approaches. Maybe I can start there next week by what I think are the flaws in those other approaches and why I would go with the futurist approach. But the point I want to illustrate here is, look how easy it is to change what a vision means just by assigning different meaning to the symbols. And who knows what the right assignment of the symbol, of the meaning of the symbols is. It's not like any of us have a code, right? I mean, that's what I always wish is, God, why didn't you, I mean, in the appendix, have a code to the symbols of Revelation? Then I could understand it. But you've given me this set of visions and symbolic language, and I don't have the foggiest idea what the symbolic vocabulary is. Somehow that's a problem that we have to get around, and I will also talk next week about how I see the process of finally getting at some kind of coming to some kind of confidence about why would I take the symbol one way or the other, and how would I decide that. So we have to solve that. But that's what makes Revelation seem so impossible to us. It's in symbolic language with no key to the meaning of the symbolism. And what are you supposed to do with that? I think that the reason that we have, I mean, a great question is to face into the question of why on earth would Jesus reveal this to us in symbolic language? This thing that is of quite a bit of importance to us. Why use symbolic language? And I think the answer to that is for the same reason he spoke in parables. And I don't know why he spoke in parables. But I think one of the reasons he spoke in parables is you have to want to understand in order to understand it. You have to want to understand it. You have to work at it. So rather than lay it all out there in straightforward, explicit, easily accessible prose for us to read and yawn and ignore, you have to already be of a disposition that I think I need to know what this means. I think I need to understand the message of this book that drives you, motivates you, sucks you in, and you begin to work at it. What on earth does this mean? And it's in the task of working at it that it begins to take shape and the message begins to confront you from it. But this is not a message for the world. This is a message to the believer. This is a message to the one who believes enough, who is not put off by the weirdness, because I recognize that there is more to reality than just day in and day out ordinary reality trucking on just like it always has been trucking on. No, there is going to come an accounting at the end of time where there are going to be dramatic events that are going to change everything. And if I already believe that, and if I already know God well enough to know that that's completely within his province, then I want to know what it is because it's been revealed to me and I want to understand it. So instead of being put off by the symbolism, I'm going to take it on and I'm going to figure it out. I think that's what the purpose of the symbolism is. Okay. We have so little time here. Any questions at this point? Before I jump into something else, or should I jump into something else? Okay, well let's begin. I want to illustrate all those different approaches from a real live example in Revelation instead of my made up example. Give you an illustration of the different approaches. In Revelation chapter 5, it says, I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne, and the one who's sitting on the throne is God, I would argue. I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a book, or better, I think, would be scroll, a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed up with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the book, the scroll, and to break its seals? And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. Then I began to weep greatly because no one was found worthy to open the book, the scroll, or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, stop weeping. Behold, the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome so as to open the scroll and its seven seals. Okay. One line of interpretation sees the scroll as the redemptive plan of God, basically the gospel, the plan of God to redeem mankind as is proclaimed in the gospel, or as one interpreter put it, God's last will and testament, which can only be implemented by Jesus. So do you see how they're taking the vision? This is simply God assigning Jesus the task to come to earth, die, be resurrected, and therein redeem mankind according to the will or plan of God, just as God had planned before the foundation of the earth. So this vision is saying something very true. Jesus is the one God sent to save the world, and this vision is simply identifying and underscoring the fact that Jesus is that one. But it's not predicting any event. It's not looking into the future particularly. And in fact, in John's time, it's looking backwards. It's just underlying and dramatizing a universal truth. So this is in the spiritual approach to Revelation, could look at the vision that way. Another way of looking at it is that the scroll is equivalent to the purposes of God in relation to his victory over the Roman Empire. So here we have a description of how God's going to defeat the Romans, who is the one who's worthy to implement that plan? Jesus. So Jesus is the one who's going to come and implement God's plan to defeat the Romans, just as we who are in bondage to Rome and under the thumb of Rome are longing for every day. That's seeing it as apocalyptic literature and looking at it as focused only, exclusively, and primarily on Jesus' victory over the Romans. Okay, or in this vision, the scroll sometimes is seen as the sentence handed down by a judge against Jerusalem for its part in shedding all the righteous blood of the prophets as well as shedding the blood of his son. And that sentence by a judge being handed down, that sentence is going to be carried out by Jesus himself. So on this interpretation, when does Jesus come and carry out God's sentence against Jerusalem, judging Jerusalem? In 70 AD, when they brought the Romans in and they destroyed the temple and destroyed the city and scattered the Jews to the winds there in 120 AD, that was God's sentence against the Jews. And this vision is simply underlining the point that it's Jesus who's going to implement God's plan to judge Jerusalem and judge the Jews. Or another line of approach takes the scroll to be the purposes of God in relation to the church and in relation to God's government of the world through the history of the church. So here's this script of how church history basically is going to go. And how, I don't know exactly how Jesus fits into that interpretation, but I guess presumably he's the only one worthy to reveal or disclose, I guess, that God's plan through church history. So when he opens the seals, he's disclosing to mankind the church history. That's the historicist approach to Revelation. So it's looking quite a ways into the future, not to the end of time, but incrementally throughout time, the various events that we can expect to happen as church history marches on. And the purpose of Revelation is to reveal that. That's what the scroll is that script. And then finally, the scroll is the title deed to the earth. The breaking of the seals is God's laying claim to and redeeming the earth for man, something that man has heretofore forfeited by his sin. God is going to come back and redeem and reclaim the earth for man, and this scroll is the title deed. So who's the one who has the authority to enforce that title deed? Jesus. And that the people who take it that way are looking at God's redeeming and laying hold of the earth for man as being at the end of the present time. So these are futurists who are looking at the text that way. So keep in mind, those are the different approaches to Revelation. I am going to take a futurist approach But as we go through here, if you have questions, why do you take it that way rather than in any of the other ways that, these various approaches to revelation take, we can talk about that. But that's the challenge before us, is out of all these different options, out of all these different ways of taking revelation, what should we do with it and how should we look at it? And we're almost out of time, so let me stop here except for any last comment or question.
If these various approaches are, if another word for them could be systems?
Mm-hmm. Or, yeah.
Why does there have to be a system of any sort? Why do you have to settle on a particular vehicle for interpreting it?
Well, I think in fairness to them, I'm not sure that their approach is to decide ahead of time, this is going to be my method, and they stick to their method. I'm talking about what they end up concluding. I don't actually know what their hermeneutic is that leads them to that, but this is where they end up, and this is their conclusions. I'm going to argue that some of the visions, the kind of spiritual interpretation is kind of the right way to see it. There are others where the preterist, I don't know, did I ever conclude? I'm not ruling out, I would not rule out ahead of time that on any given particular vision, these different approaches might be exactly the right way to take that particular vision.
So you're not necessarily conforming yourself to a system. You're going to pick and choose individual interpretations.
Right. Okay. In fact, thank you for drawing my attention to that. That's a very fundamental error that we run into, is that we talk to each other and reinforce the idea way too much that any question in theology is a multiple choice question. I mean, especially when you get to something like Revelation, and you'll constantly get questions, well, are you a premillennialist? Are you a pre-trib premillennialist or a mid-trib premillennialist or a post-trib premillennialist? Are you a preterist? You know, what? Give me a category for where you fall. That's exactly the wrong way to think about it. Theology is not multiple choice. Theology is trying to, and biblical exegesis, is trying to understand, in this case, what was it that Jesus was trying to reveal to John and through John to the rest of mankind? What was he trying to reveal to them? I don't have to be stuck in, you know, what you're calling systems of theology or systems of approach or systems of interpreting and method. I want to go whatever is true, and I need to be open to any arguments that will lead me toward what's true. So let's not think in terms of multiple choice. Let's think in terms of just understanding the text as best we can to understand what Jesus intended to say to us. And by the way, I declared myself a premillennial. I do believe premillennialism is right after looking at the book of Revelation, but I don't see the premillennialism of the popular literature. Left Behind, Hal Lindsey, the stuff that comes out of dispensational interpretations of Revelation with the rapture happening and then 7 years of tribulation and airplanes falling out of the sky and all that kind of stuff. I don't see that anywhere in Revelation. I don't think it's there. I think that's been imposed on the text. So while I will take a premillennial position, I don't think in terms of me supporting the popular literature of premillennialism.
We don't.
One more. Oh, two.
Sorry. I can see somebody saying, on the one hand, the details of Revelation are important because wisdom is for us to understand what's coming down the pipeline so that we can do something about it. We can prepare for that. We can be ready for it, you know, not just trusting that God's going to get us through it, on the one hand. Mm-hmm. I can see someone else saying the details, historical details of Revelation aren't really important because if the message is get your act straight with God, then we shouldn't be waiting until the end to do that anyway. That's something that we need to be doing today, right?
Right.
So is there a tension there? Could you expound upon how you see those two integrating or...
No, I don't think they integrate. I think the latter is right and the first one is wrong. I mean, that's the thing. I went to Revelation wanting the first. You know, should I move to Idaho or Manitoba? I mean, where should I be moving to protect myself from all this mean, nasty stuff that's going to happen? Revelation is going to help you zilch with that. It's not going to help you. In fact, when we really get into the thick of the end time events that it's talking about, you're not going to escape. They're way too big, way too dramatic. Nobody can protect themselves from that. It's going to happen. And see, one of the things that I think is almost diabolical about the popular view of eschatology and Revelation is this whole idea that the church gets raptured and then all hell breaks loose. I think what Revelation is saying is, if you're alive, all hell's going to break loose on you. You're going to be right in the thick of it. You're going to be a part of it. You're going to die or you're going to survive, but you're going to be a witness to all this stuff, and this is what's going to come down. So there is no escape from the events of Revelation. And furthermore, there isn't, it's not like David said about Isaiah, it's a mistake to think that Isaiah is history written in advance, such that you can put all the pieces together and get a picture and kind of know how it's going to, so that you could tell history in advance. Revelation won't help you. We can't tell history in advance. We are only given the barest outlines of events, but the events themselves are so dramatic that just with those bare outlines, when they occur, I think I'm going to be able to go, okay, oh, here it comes. But I can't know in advance what things are going to precede that and prepare me to get ready for that. We don't have that kind of detail, that kind of history. You know, in our fear, that's what we want. We would love to be able to do that as if we could protect ourselves from the events that are coming. But I don't think we can protect ourselves from these events. And the purpose then of Revelation is the latter thing. It's for me to take an assessment of who am I in relationship to Jesus. Have I chosen deliberately, purposely, consciously, and with my life, not my words, but with my actions and my thoughts, not merely my empty words, have I chosen to make Jesus my rabbi and listen to him and hear his warnings and heed his warnings? And that's what we have to do with it. And you're right. No matter what age we live in, that's what we have to do with it.
I would imagine this will be less than orderly sometimes, just because of the nature of all of the things each of us has been exposed to and the partially formed pictures we have. And I appreciate your courage and willingness to take this on, and as well, not only to explain your perspective on it, but to give us some tools to handle it ourselves. That is what I've seen you do repeatedly, and as always, call us to that individual choice we have to make and repeatedly make. So thanks.
Well, thanks. I'm not sure I'm doing it. I think this is what's doing it, but I'm sharing what I see. So thank you. All right. Well, we'll look at, we'll begin next week with some thinking about how we sort out the symbolism and what we do with it and so on.